Accession number 20610, Reel 1.
Jeff Welch, Reel 1. Where were you born, please?
Haringey, in London.
Which year was this?
1923.
Did you grow up and have your schooling in Haringey?
No. My folks moved to Tottenham in North London, and then we moved to Edmonton in North London, and from there I went into the army in 1943.
How old were you when you finished school?
16.
So that was just before the war broke
just
out?
Yes, before the war broke out.
Which school did you go to?
Down Lane Central School in Tottenham.
Did you hear Chamberlain declare war on Germany?
Yes, we were at home on the Sunday morning with my mother, father, myself and my younger brother, who's 4 years younger than me. And we heard the announcement on the radio, Chamberlain. And soon afterwards we heard the air raid sirens going, which we didn't know at the time, but they were testing. And my father said, oh, it'll all be over in 6 months. That was his comments. And, you know, things went from there, didn't they?
How did you feel about the news that war had broken out?
Well, not knowing anything about it, but we didn't know. We'd heard all kinds of horror stories about gas attacks, and I think the general consensus of opinion was that they were going by the First World War happenings, because it was a different war, wasn't it, the Second World War? And everyone was basing their, like, we were expecting gas attacks from the bombers and all like that. That's why everyone had their gas masks and had to carry them everywhere when they went. Wherever you went, you had your gas mask over your shoulder.
Was that much of an inconvenience?
Not really. You got used to it. I mean, everybody was carrying them. So, you know, it was just part of your fixtures and fittings that you carried about.
What was your address in the early part of the war?
42 Empire Avenue, Edmonton, North London.
Did you get much bombing in that area?
A little bit, yes. My mother and my younger brother, my father knew someone near Peterborough, and they were evacuated to Peterborough. And we used to hear them coming across London. That was like the south part of London. There wasn't much bombing in the north London. But we did have one particular night when we heard this one coming, and we heard the stick coming down, and they dropped in the next road to us. One of the stick dropped in, didn't do us any damage or anything, but my father and I were both in the double bed, and we dived out on the floor. And we heard it, we thought it was coming to us, because, you know, the noises are totally different. Fell in the next street. And but my father and I, we did the fire watching in the street during the raids. And, of course, you could hear the shrapnel coming down and hitting the roofs. But I think there was nothing else that happened in our area apart from that. Everything was going on, but not in our area.
What did the fire watching involve?
Well, I don't know how many nights a week, but so many nights a week you did 2 or 3 or 4 hours patrolling around the streets just in case, you know, any incendiary bombs, and you had to go and have your teaching with the, you know, the pumps they used to give you, the, I can't think of the name.
Stirrup
pumps. And it was general training, but most of the time, you were out and nothing was happening. I mean, if you were due for duty on that particular night, you went and did your so many hours and then went home again. Now, if nothing happened, you'd had a quiet time. But some nights, I mean, not very often over our part, it was all happening. You know, it wasn't happening. They weren't dropping the stuff on us, but of course the guns were firing from, like, different, the marshes and all like that, at the people going over from across London. I think they used to come in from the south, go across London, whatever they want, and then go out the north London, and then turn, like, their way home, fly the dogleg out again.
And did you not use shelters?
In the garden, We had an Anderson air raid shelter, which the men came and fitted. And at first it filled with water, but then they came back and they lined it with concrete and tarmac. And when my father and I were there, we didn't go down. But occasionally the mum and my younger brother, we did go down it. But see, we weren't bombed to the extent that, like, the other part of London was. I mean, if anything came our way, it was someone was dropping something, getting out of trouble. It was all happening the southern part of London. It wasn't heavily committed like with the bombing. All the flat guns were going off, but they were passing overhead. See, coming in from the south, going out through the north, they'd done their mischief, hadn't they? And other parts of London.
Were you ever frightened then in the bombing?
Not really, because we didn't have a lot of the bombing. I mean, the particular night when this one dropped to the next street, we thought it was ours. I mean, all right, that kind of thing. But, I mean, when the guns fired, you know, they were passing overhead. When the guns were firing, you took shelter because you could hear the shrapnel pitter-pattering coming back, hitting the roofs. Kind of. You didn't want to get hit with your own debris, did you?
Did you think the Germans might win the war?
No, because propaganda was on both sides was the same. I mean, I think the greatest asset we had was Churchill, because he could fire up with enthusiasm. I mean, if we'd have had Chamberlain, I think we'd have all packed in early, because he didn't have the personality that Churchill had, did he?
Did you listen to Churchill's speeches?
Oh, yes, you all did. This was all part of the ritual, wasn't it? I mean, you didn't have the television, you had your radio with the batteries in it, and, you know, at a certain time they'd say, like people like John Snagg would say, Mr. Churchill will speak to the nation, blah, 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 and you were there. That was part of the tradition. You'd listen to it.
What else would you listen to on wireless?
The news bulletins. I mean, all the ITMAR shows and whatever was going, you know, the shows, generally, what was radio was on those days. But you always listen to the 9 o'clock news of a night time and the first thing in the morning, because in the morning you had the man say, so many bombers attacked so and so last night, so many of our planes are missing, and then they carried on with the news. But it was 9 o'clock was at night was the time when everyone listened to it, and usually 7 or 8 o'clock in the morning when, you know, from the night's events.
Did you listen to Haw Haw?
Occasionally, yes. We had a laugh at it because there they you know, they said, oh, this man's an idiot kind of thing, and you, I mean, all right, there was an element of truth in what he did say, but then, you know, you were told not to listen and not to take too much notice of him. And, you know, you treated it as a joke. Radio Hamburg. Here is the Reichsämter Hamburg station, whatever it was. And then Lord Haw Haw came on. I mean, we didn't know at the time. I mean, just it was Lord Haw Haw was a Brit. We didn't know, like, it was Joyce. I mean, you know, we weren't familiar with the facts like we were later on.
And what kind of life could you have as a young man in Edmonton in the early part of the war?
Right.
Was it a normal teenage life?
Well, we were teenage. You couldn't compare teenager that day with today. I mean, right, I was working in a factory in Edmonton, and I was working a night shift, 5 nights a week, and I was earning the princely sum of £11 a week. Now, that was very, very good money. I was on this great big lathe turning out brass fittings. They said they were bomb noses, but I mean, no one knew. And the factory itself was making all kinds of things. I mean, it was working 24 hours a day. But I was on the night shift, and I, you know, your patterns change. You have lunch at 1 o'clock in the morning kind of thing. And anyway, all my mates had gone to the army, but I was in this class as a reserved occupation. So when my number came up, reserved occupation, and I couldn't go. Anyway, all most of my mates had gone. You had money for the weekend to spend, nothing to spend it on, and your mates had all gone in the forces. So eventually you got fed up with it, and I went up and volunteered. Now, that was all right volunteering, but they wouldn't let you out of reserved occupation until they'd found a replacement, which took several months, you know, how they work in the officialdom in those days. They found a replacement, then I was released. Then I joined the army then. And they asked me what I wanted to be, and I said in the Royal Armoured Corps.
Had you volunteered for the army?
Volunteered for the army. When I was called up originally, reserved occupation, I was exempt. But then, as I say, as the war progressed and I got fed up, all my mates had gone, I went up and volunteered. But I couldn't go in until someone found a replacement for my reserved occupation job.
So why did you want the army rather than another
army? Well, it was just that I fancied the army, and I fancied the armoured corps. It was just something that I fancied in those days. Don't ask me why. I mean, when I went up and volunteered, they, you know, did the medical and all like that eventually. And when I went to Richmond to do my primary training. That was in Yorkshire. Did 6 weeks in Yorkshire, do the primary training. And then when your name comes, when you've done your 6 week primary training, they put your notice up on the board of what you're going to do for training. And I was allocated the Royal Armoured School at Bovington. That's at Dorset.
Can you give me any details about what happened to you at Richmond?
Yes, it was a rifle drill. It was a typically 6 weeks initiation ceremony into the army, spit, polish, all your injections that you had. You weren't allowed out. I can't remember how long, but you weren't allowed out for a couple of weeks because your uniforms didn't fit and they all had to be tailored. You learnt generally the basic training to get you initiated into the services.
How did the people in charge of the training treat you at Richmond?
Oh, well, I mean, you just took it in your stride. Today they won't do it, they won't tolerate it, but the drill sergeants, you never satisfied the instructors, no matter how perfect you were. But, I mean, you took that in your stride. That was all part of the training, as far as we were concerned in those days. I mean, when you had kit inspections, nobody was right. I mean, they always found something somewhere. That was part of their procedure. And I mean, you know, you accepted those kind of things, where today the people don't. But I mean, this was all part of our basic training.
Did you resent being treated like that?
Not really, no. You accepted it because a different set of circumstances. I mean, the days of those days were different to the days of today. I mean, you expect a lot more of life today than what you did in those days. I mean, your basics were less, what should we say, you expected less out of life in those days because you didn't have it, did you? I mean, we had, what was I have, a 14 shillings a week was my pay. And if you allowed your mum 7 shillings or your wife 7 shillings, the army put another 7 shillings towards it. So that was 14 shillings you got for home, and then you had 7 shillings for yourself. Now, right, by the time you'd had sixpence knocked off for your haircut, sixpence for barrack room damages, you were left with 6 shillings. Now, I know prices were a lot different in those days, but 6 shillings didn't go far. So consequently, you couldn't go out on the town. You were, I mean, all right, overnight time for supper, you went to the canteen, and you had what they put out from what was over from the day with your cocoa. Occasionally you went over to the naffy, a tea and a wad, which is like a mug of tea and a bit of cake, which they had. That was tuppence, penny for the tea, penny for the cake. But 6 shillings a week didn't go far.
What happened to you at Bovington?
We got to Bovington. That was the Royal Armour Corps training place. Now, that was totally, totally different. Bovington was a beautiful barracks, but discipline was very, very strict. I mean, you had this great big rooms, what do they call them, where everybody...
Barracks?
Barracks. In your room, you had maybe 8, 10, 12 men, single beds, lockers. And, you know, the discipline was really strict. And so was the... inspections. I mean, you've had your floor that was polished, wooden floor polished, and you had what they called a bumper, like a big thing that had to polish them with. So they come in, if they find a scratch, the NCOs in charge, you'd have a restriction of some kind. And so what happened when you got went to your room, you took your boots off and you wandered around in your plimsolls, left your boots outside because you're scratching the floor. And I mean, kit inspections were. And then, of course, we went and did our training then. That was the Royal Armour Corps training. We started off driving. You had to do, when you're in a tank crew, you had to do three jobs. You had to drive a tank, which you learnt to. Bovington has got like a great big area where the tanks drive all over. And then you've got the school, the wireless school, where you had to do your wireless training. You had to learn the telegraphy, the Morse code. You had to learn how to net sets and everything like that. And then they used to take you out all around the countryside in these little pickup things with the wireless on, and you had to contact each other over the wireless. So if you didn't know how to net your set, or you couldn't contact the other people, which would might be 5 or 10 mile away, you were going in all different directions. This was all part of the wireless training. And then driving, you had to go and you drove over the moors and all like that. Had to go to school to learn how everything worked. So I mean, it was a very, very intensive training thing. And then after we finished that, we did the, I can't remember how long the courses were, the two courses we did at Bovington. Then we went and did the gunnery, which was about 12 mile up the road at Lulworth Cove. Now, Lulworth Cove was the gunnery, the RAC gunnery school for that area. So we moved down to Lulworth, they had all the huts there and everything. And you went and you got learned about the 75s, and I mean, you could take any gun to pieces blindfolded because this was partly of intensive training and everything like that. Then of a night time, their huts, they had the very, very, very basic form of simulator, where they had a air gun on the side and the turret without the turret on it, the whole workings of the turret, and in front of you, or some several yards up the hut, was like a moving. You could switch it on, and it targets would move, and the scenery would move, as if you had to hit a moving target. Then you sat there with your gun sights and everything. It was all scaled down to what it was, but it was a proper thing. And you fired this 2-2 at these targets that popped up, moved out. It was learning ranges and aiming off, everything like that. And then later on, we went out to the main range and fired our 75 millimeter cannon and our 300 Brownings at various targets, all out, and that was at Lulworth Cove. Now, I mean, you were firing about 1,000 yards, hitting targets, and like that. And very often these AP, there was no HE, it was all AP, armour piercing things, and they would ricochet and go right out into the sea. They had to put the red flag out, showing that it was firing at Lulworth Cove. And you learnt then, and anyway, finally, after about 8 months, you passed. You had to pass for your driving, pass for your wireless telegraphy, which was 8 words a minute, and learning how to do that, and your gunnery. Now, right, the day came when you were assessed on your what you'd done. Right, now, if you were good at driving, you went to a driver, as a driver, gunner operator, a gunner mechanic, they called it. Then, if you were good at wireless operator, you went as a telegraphist. Then, if you were good at gunnery, you went as what they called a gunner operator, which was like a gunner come wireless operator. You see, in a crew, you had to be able to do every job and satisfactorily because you didn't know how you'd have to, although you specialised what you were good at. You had to be able to, if you were gunner and someone said move it, you had to be able to climb in to move it and do that. Same as if you had to net the wireless, if the wireless operator was gone away, you had to be able to net tune in your wireless, get the codes and everything like that. So although you specialised in your job, you had to know how to do it. And then finally came the day of posting when everything went up on the wall, and I passed out as a gunner operator. So I was a gunner. Then I was assigned to the Royal Scots Greys. Didn't know anything about the regiment, nothing at all. And they were stationed at Worthing. Now, I went to Worthing, joined them. Anyway, the troops, the Scots Greys, had come back from Italy. They'd been all through the Middle East, but I mean, they'd been out into Italy, and they'd been brought back as they were reasonable troops, you know. Didn't bring their equipment back, but the men had come back, the crews had all come back, and they were stationed at Worthing, the back end of the town. And they were got all new Shermans, and I arrived when the new Shermans were coming. So they had, we were all in like this hall for messes and things like that in the houses where we billeted. And then, as I said, always remember this, the one of our officers that we know, they met you and all like that into the regiment, told us some of the history of it and said, "You're tank crew, but now we're going to make you into tank men, because you have to do your with your fellow man, your crew. A crew has to be compatible, don't they? I mean, you can't have anybody acting up horrible in a crew, because you're all responsible, you're relying on each other." So anyway, this was all part of it all happening. I mean, they brought new different tracks. We had to change it. It was gradually, it was getting initiated into the system of being a tank crew. And the beauty of it was that, I mean, most of the crews were the same. You had like a couple of experienced men from Italy, a couple from like Africa, and you had, say, two new boys. So the new boys had the experience of the experienced people. You know, I mean, of course, there was a hell of a lot to learn. I mean, you'd done your training, now you had to learn to be a crew, didn't you? And anyway, finally, I mean, all kinds of things happened. We used to walk right through the town. Worthing Pier, where the Perthing Pier and the big theatre place is now, was a huge naffy. And we used to walk down through the town of a night time to the naffy on that pier. And anyway, eventually we were all set and everything like that. And we didn't know what was happening. I mean, Monty came down one day on one of his travels and gave us a talk and all like that. Anyway, finally.
What impression did Montgomery make?
Oh, he was, you know, he gave his pep talk. I mean, we'd never seen the man. I mean, he stood on the bonnet of a Jeep and, you know, there was, it wasn't just us. I mean, there was a whole load of troops. Because you've got to remember that all the South Coast was a parking area. There was equipment everywhere of, name it, it was down there. So, I mean, there was no civilian cars parked in the street. Every side street, green, everywhere you looked, was things parked up. And, you know, it was the South Coast kind of thing, was just one huge equipment park kind of thing. And anyway, we knew something was on, because we had to start waterproofing the tanks. It was like a plasticine, and you stuck it all round the ports, round the edge of the turrets, to keep waterproof out. And they gave us these great big chimneys at the back where the exhaust is, sticking up the back, which we had to put in. I mean, if you had to go through the water, you didn't want the water running through your exhaust. So we stuck these chimneys on, and you had your guns with all the different things on them. Anyway, by the time you had to move, you and your crew were compatible. And I mean, the things you learn, it's amazing. You know, because you've become crew. You know your job. Now you've got to become crew. And I mean, you learn how to line up your guns, and you know, you. I mean, you know, if the 50-gallon of petrol came and the driver was away, you had to be able to get up there and put it in and all like that, same as if the driver had to come and lower or higher and do something with the gun, he had to come and do it. But we had three people from from Italy. We had the lieutenant, who was the commander. We had the driver, Pete Kemble, And then we had Mush Taylor, he was the operator come loader. So in the tank, the wireless operator had to also do gun loading. I mean, he sat the other, you sat on the right-hand side as gunner on the Shermans. He sat the left-hand side, his job was the radio, and he had to load the weapons, like whether it was the Browning 300 machine gun, coax, or the 75mm main armament. And of course, round the side you had all your racks of ammunition, but under the gun itself you had what they called a ready box. There was 19 rounds in those, mixture of HE and AP. That was like the, for immediately, if you wanted something quickly. I mean, the other stuff was stuck round the sides underneath in the main ammunition thing. But this was the 19 rounds, what they called the ready box. And of course, in the corners were the Browning boxes with 250 round belts that went through the 300 Browning coax. And anyway, we were all ready then. Then they made us move from Worthing to Portsmouth. Now, you've got to remember, I was 20 years of age, coming up 21. The South Coast, I didn't know anything about it at all. I mean, we went all along the South Coast from Worthing to Portsmouth. We had the DRs, you know, the motorbike escorts and everything like that. But everywhere along that South Coast, no matter what, I mean, we kept to the main roads. But everywhere you looked was equipment. Everywhere, everywhere, everywhere. We arrived at Portsmouth. They told it was Portsmouth. It could have been Timbuktu for all I know. I didn't know. And it was still by the coast. And we got stuck in a side street. Then we went into the houses and lived and all like that. And we went down to the beaches. On the beaches was all these landing craft and landing ships. Now, right, every so often, every couple of days, your turn to come down, to go on the beach, reverse up into these various ships and all like that. And when you were on there, you had great big chains that went through your suspensions that chained you to the deck. And then, right, when you were all settled like that, sometimes they would go out into, which we now know is the estuary, but as far as we were concerned, it was the sea. They'd move around, they'd be like, come back, then you'd all have to unload again and drive back to your allocated or designated street. I mean, everybody was doing that at different times on these various craft to, I suppose, just to see if you could do it and how to. But you always backed into the craft and so that you could drive out. Anyway, on this particular day, I mean, we knew things were happening, but we didn't know. I mean, you know, we were tiny cogs in a huge wheel, weren't we? We didn't know. No one told us anything. And we knew, but something was afoot. You know, there was all kinds of rumour going round. Anyway, on this particular day, we went down to the beach again and got on this LST. And we dropped, six of us went on, backed on, plus a few B vehicles and other things, you know, on there. They were way back, with six were in the front. And all chained down and everything like that, right, lovely, yeah. Going out into the estuary again, oh, you know, this is another bit of fun kind of thing. And then, but this time, we didn't come back. And we were out in the estuary all that day. Anyway, come the evening, we said, you know, what's happening? Like, anyway, there was all kinds of rumours going on. Anyway, later on in the evening, we heard all the aeroplanes going over. Masses and masses and masses of aircraft. So we knew that something was on. And then in the night, we sailed. We didn't know where we were. I mean, black. It makes you wonder, with all that shipping out there, what ships didn't hit each other? Because no one had lights on. I suppose they must have had reds and greens on, but they weren't lit up or anything. And anyway, come the morning, it was a terrible night. The rain, the wind, and the old boat was, you know, doing this kind of thing. A terrible crossing. Anyway, because in those days, June, it was an early morning, you know, the daylight came. The thing I can remember is when the daylight came, looking round, coming up on deck, looking round, and as far as you could see, in any direction, there were ships, boats, name it, it was out there. But the thing was, we got stuck and out there. Anyway, finally got ashore at D plus one. It wasn't D-Day. It wasn't D-Day. It was D plus one. And we landed on what we now know as Salt Beach. We didn't know, as far as we were concerned, it was salt, it was a bit of beach. And I think when we got ashore, it was still going on, but it had gone inland a couple of miles. So we came ashore up towards what we now know as the mouth of the River Orne to the left. I mean, we didn't know it was going up there. There was a hell